My name is Noelle Hanrahan, and you're listening to Flashpoints, KPFA's investigative news magazine. On the phone, we have Tanya Brannon of the Purple Berets. She's an investigator and a bilingual victims advocate and specializes in domestic violence. She's talking to us today about the Palfini case, which was dismissed on Tuesday the 18th. It was a murder trial. Now, Tanya Brannon, bring us up to date. What happened in this case?
Well, Louis Palfini is a rich Petaluma doctor who was charged with homicide and domestic violence in the death of his wife, Janet Palfini, in November of 1999. Louis Palfini had called 911 saying that his wife had committed suicide by putting her head in a bucket, and that he had administered CPR for 10 minutes, but that she was gone. The responding officers, both of whom were rookies, when they came out to the scene, within a few minutes, they got together and they said, this is a suspicious death. And they called in their sergeant and felt very, very much that this was a possible homicide. And they felt that for several reasons. One was the injuries on Janet Palfini. She had a big goose egg and bruise on her head. She had abrasions and bruising around her mouth and chin. There were abrasions on her arms and on an ankle. The position of the body was suspicious. The bucket was empty, had no water in it, and Janet Palfini had no water on her head or the top part of her body. So these two rookies immediately knew that there was something going on here and it had nothing to do with suicide. They called in their sergeant. He agreed and called in the Sheriff's Department's violent crimes investigator, and that team responded. At that point, the deputy, the detective with the violent crimes team, knew Palfini by reputation. He said he was a fine, upstanding member of the community. He didn't think a crime had been committed, so this was not investigated as a crime.
What was that deputy's name?
His name was Detective York. And what that meant was, because they didn't call it a homicide or a suspicious death, that no evidence was taken from the scene at all. They didn't take the bucket. They didn't take Janet Palfini's clothes. They didn't check for tissue under her fingernail, if there had been some kind of struggle. They didn't take Louis Palfini's clothes. There was no real crime investigation launched at that point. They did, however, have a deputy attend the autopsy. And later, after all the toxicology and everything had come back in, the pathologist ruled it a homicide, that she had been smothered to death.
How many weeks later was that?
This was 6 or 7 weeks later. Actually, it's in question exactly when he determined it was a homicide. So at that point, a grand jury was convened, which is a very unusual move. In this county, almost always crimes are handled by a preliminary hearing rather than a grand jury. What we hear is that was done to protect Palfini's reputation if it turned out he was innocent. But the grand jury did find that there was probable cause that he had committed the homicide, and at that point he was charged. And this was almost a year later, he was charged with homicide and domestic violence in Janet Palfini's death.
Now, why would it take a year to proceed in that case?
Good question. Again, I think it's very clear. Detective York said on the stand that he was swayed by Dr. Palfini's position in the community. So, and that's why it wasn't done immediately. Why it took that long, I'm really not certain. What kicked off that grand jury investigation, I'm really not certain.
How does race and class play into this?
Well, I think heavily. One of the reasons that we got involved in this case is because exactly the same time Louis Palfini was being charged, we had another domestic violence homicide in this county, and that was the homicide, a young working-class woman, Debbie Zuber, murdered her batterer, a man who had beaten terrorized and threatened to kill her for a period of 2 years. So we saw immediately that this was going to be an interesting case study in how the criminal justice system deals differently with domestic violence cases when the alleged perpetrator is a rich white doctor as opposed to a young working class woman.
Give us a thumbnail sketch of what has happened to Zuver and where she is now.
Well, Debbie Zuver, not being rich, was not able to hire the... Paul Feeney is a defense attorney, is probably the most expensive and best defense attorney in town. Debbie Zuver didn't have that option. And so she was represented by the public defender, who certainly doesn't have the time and the resources that a private attorney does. She, as her trial approached and she did not feel that the work had really been done that would help her to get off or to get a reasonable sentence, she took the option of pleading guilty to manslaughter. The reason being, of course, if she had been convicted of first-degree murder, she was looking at the possibility of life without possibility of parole. That's a really heavy thing to stare in the face when you were protecting yourself.
And did she spend all of her pretrial time in prison?
She did. Debbie was arrested the night of the homicide, and she never was released from jail from that time. By contrast, Paul Feeney wasn't arrested for a year. He spent, I think, 2 days in jail and posted $750,000 bail in an afternoon and has been released pending trial.
Now, tell us about the trial. You just spent your time sitting in throughout the entire trial until this case was dismissed. Bring us up to date on that.
It's been a very interesting look into the criminal justice system, I gotta say. The early testimony, of course, was the responding officers and the investigating officers, as well as the emergency medical people at the scene. It was, the evidence to me has been very compelling. Paul Feeney changed his story several times. First he said he performed CPR for 10 minutes, then later he admitted he didn't perform CPR at all. He changed his story about the position he found the body in. He went from suicide to, oh, maybe it was a heart attack, oh, maybe it was this. So his response and his conduct when he was being interviewed by the investigators was very suspicious. They said that he cried a lot, but there were no tears, that it was like a theater performance. So I think it was pretty compelling that this was not a suicide and this was not a natural death and that there was more to it. But because there had been no homicide investigation, the entire case hinged on the testimony of the county's pathologist, the person who did the autopsy and determined the cause of death. This was a Dr. Gill. His testimony during the trial, first we had a little trial within a trial where Dr. Gill's background came into question. In June, the defense attorneys had released through the press an attack on Dr. Gill's credibility, saying that he'd been fired from another job with another coroner's office. He'd had his medical license revoked due to a drunk driving arrest. And so from June on, it was very clear. I mean, we were calling this the OJ trial of Sonoma County. The defense strategy was to attack the investigation and the pathologist report rather than to present any evidence that Louis Paul Feeney was innocent. Well, we weren't disappointed. We had a trial within the trial, going through Gill's background and him explaining all that away. And at the end of that, the judge did rule that he could testify as an expert witness. Now, Gill had ruled this a homicide by smothering, that someone had put something, some kind of fabric, over Janet Pelfini's mouth and smothered her to death.
And during his testimony, what did he say and why did he make that assessment?
Well, the way he described it, death by smothering is an elimination of other possibilities. They ruled out drowning. I mean, there was no water in her lungs. She didn't drown. The injuries to her face and arms and legs were not injuries that could have happened in a fall, and he went through an explanation as to why that was true that was very compelling. And he ruled out asthma. One of the defense strategies was that she had died from an acute asthma attack. And he went through extensive testimony on what a death by acute asthma attack looks like, and this wasn't it.
Now tell us about prosecutorial misconduct in that their whole case hung on his testimony, and what happened that this case was dismissed?
In the midst of Gill's testimony, it came to light that Dr. Gill had been coached by a speech pathologist. And when it came out that this was the case, it also came out that there were videotapes and tape recordings of those sessions. Immediately, the defense moved for discovery on those videotapes. And they were turned over to the judge. Then the prosecutor walks in with this big backpack filled with 24 hours of videotapes, two cassette recordings, and a pile of documents. The judge looked at these videos, or at least some of them, in the beginning, and was very, very distressed by what he had seen. And he ruled that some of them could be turned over to the defense immediately, and then he would review the rest of them to see if they were attorney work product. In the end, I think he turned over all of them to the defense. What the defense saw when they looked at those videotapes was Dr. Gill's testimony being cooked, basically, by the speech pathologist. There were sessions. Now, the prosecutor said that they were aware that Gill was being coached, but that their understanding was that it was to help him present better on the stand, that he didn't make a good presentation, he rambled, those kinds of things, and that he had specifically instructed them not to talk about the Pelfini case, the specifics of this case. However, what the videotape showed was them rehearsing Dr. Gill's answers to questions about not just his background, but about his autopsy on the Pelfini case, and in fact, changing answers. I mean, one of the things they changed was the date that he determined it was a homicide. And in one instance, apparently, and I haven't seen the tapes, but this is according to the defense attorneys and the other attorneys, in one instance, he said an answer. The speech pathologist suggested that he say something else, and he said, no, this is what Brooke Halsey told me to memorize. Brooke Halsey was the prosecutor on the case. So it was very explosive. Clearly, he had been coached in how he would answer questions on the stand in this case and change those answers to fit the prosecution's standpoint.
I'd just like to interject two quotes from John Raymer's Daily Journal article that came out. He says, Judge Dahm said from the bench, quote, I've been in the system for 30 years, and I've never seen anything quite like it. Now, the defense attorney in the case says, quote, this is the most contemptible, absurd, and despicable prosecution act that I've seen in 30 years of practice. While the prosecutor, Brooke Halsey, said it was embarrassing and wrong, but was surprised to learn of those coaching sessions. What do you make of the supervisory responsibility and the trail of authority here?
Well, Brooke Halsey, who is the prosecutor, even if he was not involved in cooking Gill's testimony, which we'll go into why I think he was, even if he wasn't involved in that process and basically suborning perjury, he certainly knew that his primary witness, the witness that his entire case hinged on, was being coached, and that he needed to protect the integrity of that witness at all costs. So he should have been very, very hands-on. These were sessions, Noel, that went on once or twice a week, 90 minutes a time, from June until November. So it wasn't like, you know, they had a couple of sit-downs with the guy. They worked with him over a period of months. for Brooke Halsey not to know what was going on in those sessions was irresponsible, absolutely. But I think he did know what was going on in those sessions. Apparently on one of the tapes, it shows Dr. Gill being questioned. Roy Gourley, who was with the Sheriff's Department, was in the room, as was the speech pathologist. A door opens. Everybody says, "Hi, Brooke, come on in, take a seat." And then the videotape is turned off. So Halsey walked in on a taping session. There's no doubt that he knew stuff was being videotaped. And then, as I said, on the one video, Gill says, "This is what Brooke told me to memorize." We've also just learned today through someone inside the DA's office that the problems with Dr. Gill had been brought to the attention of the district attorney over a year ago. In working on another case, this person found Gill to be incompetent and was concerned about the effect on that case and on other cases in the office. So it was no surprise to anybody in the DA's office that they had a real problem with Dr. Gill.
Now, you sat down with Mike Mullins, the district attorney for Sonoma County. What was your interaction with him like?
His thing was, Brooke Halsey did nothing wrong. And I said, "Have you seen all the videotapes? Have you watched these 24 hours of videotape?" "Well, no, I haven't, but people in my office have." Well, on further questioning, it turned out that people in his office had not seen all the videotapes. One person said, "Oh, well, I've seen all but about 2 hours." So there were certain hours of the videotape that had not been reviewed by the district attorney's office. And I even gave him a chance to say the right thing. I said, "Oh, then you mean you're not opening an investigation until you see the rest of the videotapes?" And he said, "I'm not opening an investigation. Brooke Halsey did nothing wrong. He upheld the highest standards of integrity of this office." My response to that is, precisely, that's the problem.
In today's Center as a Press Democrat, it appears that the jury that was impaneled have been making comments. What have they been saying?
There was an article discussing the jury's dismay at what had happened and their questions. And in that article, several of the jurors stated that they thought that the DA's case was very compelling. Of course, what's happening in the press here is this poor beleaguered doctor who the DA, you know, the system went after and tried to make up a homicide. Justice has been done. The innocent man has been released. So it was very interesting to see that the jury did not feel that an innocent man had been released. They were really concerned that this, you know, this was a person who may well have committed murder and was now loose in this community.
What does it mean that the district attorney's office acted in this way, and what does it mean for domestic violence homicide prosecutions?
This kind of sloppiness, at the very least, you know, we'll try to give them the benefit of the doubt and not call it suborning perjury and obstruction of justice. At the very least, this kind of sloppiness has been what's plagued domestic violence investigations in this county for the 10 years that I've been working on it. And I mean from top to bottom, from the responding deputies to the district attorney. So it's not surprising. This is business as usual. The only thing that's different about this case, in my opinion, is that it was caught on videotape.
Well, I'd like to thank you, Tanya Brannon. You're an investigator with the Purple Berets, a bilingual women's advocate, and you work on domestic violence issues and follow it in counties throughout the Bay Area and nationally.